Hello and welcome to All Brother, a podcast about Manchester / Salford's legendary musical institution, The Fall. Each week we invite along a guest to chat about their memories and interactions with the group. You can find us on Spotify and Apple and all usual subjects, but we're hosted at shows.acast.com/OH-brother. For episode 2 of series 4, we spoke to Phil Jones, a legendary Manchester promoter, who as well as being responsible for the Stone Roses' iconic gig at Spike Island, has also worked with New Order, John Cooper Clarke and of course The Fall, including a memorable trip to Brazil in 1989. He's also responsible for the world-renowned Manchester Food and Drink Festival. Truly a man for all seasonings. Hope you enjoy our conversation. Right, good evening. But this is
evening,
Steve. This is episode 2 of series 4 of the Old Brother podcast. Have you been well since we last spoke? Been up to much?
I've been out and about.
Yeah, a little bit of this, a little bit of that, you know. Mm-hmm. Right, so we'll crack on, shall we? Our guest this evening is Phil Jones, the legendary promoter, manager, record company impresario.
Thought you weren't going to pick him up.
Well, yeah, well, you can't just go in, you know. There are other Phil Joneses are available. I mean, I've done a football, so, you know, you've got to be careful, haven't you?
Okay. Well,
without further ado, good evening, Mr. Jones. Are you well?
Yeah.
Good evening.
Yeah, fine. Nice to hear from you.
Keeping busy?
Oh, yeah, always busy. Always busy. Never stop being busy. Wish I did. I'm too old to be doing this. Should have been.
You're only as old as how you feel. I'm sure you're in your prime.
Yeah, prime-ish, yeah.
Right, so
it's going well, is it?
Yeah, it all goes well. It's always hard work making an honest dollar, but it's you know, it all goes reasonably well. Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah, good. I mean, if you wanted to bring everybody down, we could talk about how you plied your trade during lockdown or how you didn't ply your trade during lockdown. I bet that was a bit difficult, wasn't it?
Well, it was a weird one because I had something like 85 gigs cancelled in that period, I think, or maybe more, 95, nearly 100 gigs.
Wow.
And not only, so they were all cancelled and then we had to reschedule them, and then we had to reschedule them again. And I've just finished, well, back end of May, we finished a tour with Gretchen Peters, and 3 of the shows that she did this year went on sale in 2018.
Good God.
I'm not joking. They were on sale for 4.5 years because we just kept having to move them. And
Then,
you know, everybody else was moving gigs, so the venues had to have the availability. So you were sort of saying, right, I've got 8 gigs, I've got to move here. And you were going to the 8 venues and saying, can you do the 16th of April? And they were saying, no, because we've just moved so-and-so there. So you'd have to go back to the 4 you put in and say, can you now do... And it was... mentally...
That sounds like a nightmare, yeah.
And only when all the promoters have to do the same thing, all the venues, most of us came out of it all right, but it was kind of a stress in that you just never experienced before.
Right, yeah. So what did you do with yourself during lockdown then?
Well, I walked the dog a lot, did a lot of you know, rearranged gigs.
Yeah.
Literally, the first couple of months, because we were then, you know, the gigs in whenever we got locked down, sort of April, May, we then all moved to October, November, and then it was like, well, in October, November, January, February. Well, there's not going to be a January, February, so it was March. And it just went on and on.
Yeah.
Say, great pieces. Some of her, 3 of her shows that she did in May originally went on sale in 2018.
We were glad we got out of the music biz during lockdown, weren't we, Paul?
We were, yeah. We got down out of the music biz because of lockdown, I think, didn't we?
Yeah,
I think so. Well, we did time that quite well, didn't we? It was one of the few times you've ever timed anything. Well, the band kind of fizzled to an end just before lockdown, and then we started somewhere else just after lockdown. It sounds like we meant it, doesn't it?
Well, I mean, there was a lot of people came out of lockdown feeling better. I certainly would. I mean, you know, I was glad of the rest, not having to go in the office and not having to, you know, just be on that kind of fast pace, you know, going and all that. It did a lot of good. And to be honest, working from home, which I've never really done before, I'm still doing it now. I very rarely go into our office in Manchester these days.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a lot of that, isn't there, that you people suddenly realise, what the bloody hell am I spending this amount of time travelling when I can do it all at home?
Well, it's the travel thing. And I live, you know, 12, 13 miles outside the city centre. And if you're driving there and back, you know, and you're coming back at half five in the evening in the car, it's like you get home, like you've just had it, you know. But now, probably 3 hours of my day extra. But anyway, let's move on. It's all gone.
Let's move on. It's too depressing, isn't it? Yeah. Right, so I was going to start with when you went to Manchester Uni. That's what that would be, late 70s, was it?
No, I'm old.
Late 78, was it?
No, I finished in late 78.
Ah, right, okay. One of the reasons I ask, because I know that was in how you got into it and everything, but is it true or is this an urban myth that I've read somewhere? That the young ones were based on the people you and the people you live with. Is that true?
You're not supposed to know that.
It's a good bit of research there, Paul.
Yeah, I do my best, you know.
We'll have to. I know where that's good. That was in the Evening News, wasn't it, years ago? Well found. You'll have to ask Ben Elton, who I'll say was a frequent visitor to my house. I mean, Rick and Adrian lived in a similar mad environment, but. All I'll say
is yes, then.
The little guy and the young ones, and you know,
Mike.
Yeah, who knows?
Mike, the cool person. That's you, is it?
Who knows where he came from?
You're taking the fifth at this point, are you?
Well, you know, who knows? It's an interesting question, but certainly, what I will say is, and weirdly, I'm working with him now. Nigel Planer's character. Was based on a character I live with. Yeah, definitely.
So you're working with Nigel Planer?
No, I'm working with Nigel now. Yeah, he's touring with Henry Normal as one of my acts. Yeah.
Ah, right, okay. So he had a look at your book, Steve, didn't he, Nigel Planer?
He did. He was very. He gave us some great feedback right at the beginning, which kind of changed the whole way it ran.
Okay. Well, interesting, thoughtful guy, Nigel. Very pleasant bloke, I might say.
Yeah, he used to run. Writing workshops. I don't know if he still does. Maybe he does. But he looked at it, and for some reason, he had to go to London on the train, and he took it with him. And instead of just a few pages of feedback, he gave us a couple of chapters of feedback, which really, really worked in our favour.
Well,
it's cool. With a good book, Steve. I thoroughly enjoyed reading it. You know,
Indeed. So. Right, so when you were at uni, that was when you started promoting with the union gigs, was it? Students' union?
What happened was, 1978, I graduated, and I'd been knocking around with one of the you might call them a post-punk band called The Knives. You might remember them. They were all sort of mad hippies in Manchester.
Oh, don't remember them.
They were very much on the sort of what I call the Hunt Saboteur benefit circuit. We played one gig in somewhere like Chorlton Irish Centre or something like that, maybe a West Indian Centre, Carmel Road. And the supporting band were a group called the Durrussy Column.
Oh, wow.
I've never heard of them, but I remember turning up for the sound check. And as you know, the support band sound checks after the main band, and Durrussy's were definitely a support band. There was this almighty din coming out of this centre as I turned up. Knives hadn't even turned up, you know, even though they were due to be there.
Yeah.
And I walked in, and there's this band playing, this weird guy playing the guitar, drummer, bass player. And the sound man was a guy called Oz McCormack.
Blimey.
Oh, God, remember Oz?
Yeah.
And I said to Oz,
he taught us everything we know, didn't he?
He did.
We can come to Oz. And I said to Oz, what's going on? These are the support band. He said, Tony Wilson's been in, he slipped me £25 so they could do the support, they could do the sound check first. I learned a lesson that night, and that was sort of June 78 when I just graduated. And then what happened was, is that I took over, I got the first dibs on using the squat on Dever Street, which was the old College of Music, just at the, well, it's now the Concert Hall.
Yeah.
And I started promoting there with another guy about every Friday. And the reason we got the job is because we were able, and the reason we got bands to play for us was that, well, number one, the venue was great. But number two, we were able to get the posters screen printed at a place called 178 Waterloo Place. And Steve, this guy I was promoting with, was a great screen printer. So the bands all knew that if they got a gig with us, they'd get the posters done. And we were, you know, that was just kind of, you know, that was a learning thing. But I started playing guitar, including a very early version of the Fall.
Yes. That, Tony Friel's last gig, that one, is Steve, the squat.
Probably, yeah. I think Tony.
I saw them at the squat with Eric.
Oh, right. Well, yeah, so maybe Eric's first gig, sorry, yeah.
Yeah, they are. Well, and I think that was actually Eric's last gig.
Was it really, the ferret? Wow. Well, I mean, I didn't know anybody at all.
I don't know where they get this reputation for big turnover of members. Do you?
No. Yeah, well, that was it for some reason. But I didn't know any of the band, and it was the Fall were just one band on a list of three or four, maybe. But I've been talking to this guy, kept saying to me, he's a French guy, he ran a pancake house in Salford Keys, believe it or not. He had a barge in Salford Keys in 1978, selling pancakes. I have this great PA, Phil, you must use it. So I hired this PA off him for 52 quid, I'll never forget. And of course, there was no monitors or anything. It was just basically a vocal PA. And I was very worried when I realised. The Fall came in, played a blinder, and I was a bit sheepish afterwards, you know, sort of hiding from Kay, who was the manager. And she came and said, "Oh, one of the best gigs we've ever had, mate. Thanks very much." And I went, "Oh, well, there you go. You can get away with not spending much on the
That's an uncanny impression. Oh, my God.
Well, But yeah, she was an interesting character, Kay. So, I mean, I don't remember anything about the band at all. I do remember this sort of bizarre singer who couldn't sing, but and it being a bit of a racket, but I enjoyed it, I remember. So that was probably the back end of 78, early 79.
So were you, I think I saw mentioned that you did an early New Order gig. Was that the one at the squat?
No, that was after the spot, but not long after the spot. That was I became the president. I had a year off after uni when I was promoting these bands, and then went to a place called City of Manchester College of Higher Education, Comanche for sure.
Comanche, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah.
Otherwise known as Elizabeth Gaskell, otherwise known as Domsky. And I did a postgraduate education there. I knew from day one I wasn't going to be a teacher, but, you know, my parents were putting a bit of pressure on me. But it was a great student union, little sort of place, you know. And the sabbatical president elections came up, and this guy persuaded me to stand to be president, and I won it with 88 votes. He got 87, and he was called Paul James, and I'm Phil Jones, and our campaign was Vote the PGA Way. The point of the story is we got this students' union, and New Order played in there in late January 81, and you can see a great film of it actually on the that New Order album that they completely repackaged with a load of DVDs, and there's a film of them playing Ceremony at that gig with Wilson actually holding one of the cameras. Tony bought all the Granada crew from Granada, you know, who'd been doing on a foreigner from Granada Reports, and they filmed the gig, and there's a film of that. And I always say, if people say, "What's the best gig you've ever seen?" I'll say loads of my best gigs, but the best 5 minutes of any gig was New Order playing Ceremony at that gig. It was probably January 28, 1981, something like that.
Yeah.
And it was...
They can't have been going long then.
Their first proper advertised gig. And believe it or not, the capacity was 1,200 and we only sold out on the night.
Blimey.
Yeah.
So you were at the first gig, weren't you, Steve, at the...
Yeah, at the Beach Club.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't part of that scene. I didn't become part of that scene that sort of Richard Boone and all that what ran until kind of about a year after that. I moved into the office with Richard just after that.
That on Newton Street?
Yeah, 50 Newton Street, New Hormones.
Yes. I know it well. I used to hang around there as a young and impressionable Buzzcocks fan.
Yeah. Well, we didn't used to see the Buzz as much, apart from when they came in and asked where the money was.
So I could write a book about that.
Yeah. Somewhere. It's such a shame Shelley's not here to tell the tale, because he'd probably laugh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So then you started doing... Did you start doing the Rock and Red Racism gigs with the Fall as well? You did them, didn't you, some of them?
I did. What happened was is that whilst I was doing these gigs at the squat, a lot of them were Rock Against Racism gigs, and I got to know only three or four people who were running it in Manchester, and it was my job to not just do gigs in the squat, because it was all a bit studenty, but take them out to places like Cheetham Hill, Monton, you know, and I was working in little church halls with bands like Exodus and, I don't know, well, in The Fall occasionally. I had with The Fall and Harlem Spirit on Cheetham Hill in the library at Cheetham Hill. Does that ring any bell? Has that ever been read?
You'd have been a fan then, would you? What kind of year are we talking in that?
We're talking about 80, 81, 1980, 81. I might be wrong. Oh.
I was in it then, yeah.
So was I.
Yeah. I mean, The Fall and Harlem Spirit.
It's something like that, I'm sure, but I get a bit confused. I mean, it's at this stage, I always say, you know, you wish you'd filmed it because, honestly, memories get very bad.
Yeah, we were talking about that before, about if only we'd have known at the time, you know, you'd have kept a diary or took some photos or something.
Well, I read that book by, who is it? I can't remember. He's done a list of like all the alternative gigs in Manchester, and so many hours in Belgium, I can't believe it. But it was only when I saw them listed, I thought, bloody hell, I organised that. You know, you just forget it. It's a shame.
Yeah.
Over the years, I've kept a vague tally. I think I've promoted 7,000 gigs about that, where people paid money to get in. Not one tribute band.
Right, that's quite some doing these days, isn't it?
It is.
So that's, I take it that's a point of principle, is it?
Well, it was at first, and now it's just that none of the agents were tribute bands. So I have to say, you know, people like the Academy Music Group make their living out of, you know. But,
yeah.
So I've never touted with the agents who deal with them. So, you know, it's long gone now.
Were you involved in the Big Rock Against Racism gig in Alec Park in 78? Was that, were you anything to do with that?
Weirdly enough, that was the day I graduated with my BA Econ Honours from Manchester University, or the 2 days after Graham Parker played on the day I graduated. And we literally just got there in time to see Graham. And the gig in the park was 2 days later on the Saturday.
Yes.
Weirdly, I must have known somebody who was helping with the Graham Parker gig, because I ended up being on the Saturday, the big RAR gig with Buzzers, and who was on the bill? It was
Exodus. It was Thingy, wasn't it? It was. This is terrible, isn't it?
Steel Pulse. Yes.
Yeah.
Pulse were definitely on. There was a Pung.
Yeah, and Buzz Cox and
were on, and there was that band called China Street where they were, because I met them and I ended up working with them quite a bit. But at that particular gig, I became in charge of the fundraising, i.e. running the buckets, to get the cash in, you know. And my little blue minivan became the headquarters for where the cash was going. But I also somehow ended up with the kettle in there. So everybody who was running the gig was coming and getting a brew off me, and I was running. We literally dug a hole under my minivan and put this cash in. It was big change at the time, which was coming in buckets, put it in a hole under my car. But I ended up, key moment in my life, the guy who was overall running the whole Rock Against Racism thing, was he a guy called Red somebody? Red
Saw? Yes, he was. Red. I've got his name here somewhere.
I gave him a lift to Piccadilly Station back, and we got talking. And that's really how I got involved with Rock Against Racism. He said, "Oh, look, we're really trying to build this all over. Will you get involved?" I'm like, "Yeah, of course, you know. Thanks very much." So, yeah.
There's a quote from Richard Boone, isn't there, saying, "I believe in what the. If these people are organising the revolution, I'm emigrating."
Richard's never been anything but a cynic.
He's an old hippie.
No, he is. I went to school with Richard, you know.
Did you?
And Howard.
Yeah. At Leeds. An old Leo Denzian, are you?
I'm an old Leo Denzian. And Richard and Howard were two, maybe 3 years older than me. Everybody had long hair and, you know, looked a bit scruffy. They had short, cropped red hair, both of them.
Well, I think Richard's always had short, cropped red hair.
Yeah, he has, exactly. And walked around in brown brogues and very tight trousers, no flare whatsoever. They stood out like a pair of weird guys, you know. And who would have thought they'd have gone on to, you know, change a culture, really.
They changed everything, didn't they?
Yeah. I mean, Rich is a very clever bloke.
He is. Saw him not so long ago. So he came to, we did a book thing with Kevin Cummins.
Yeah.
And he came along to that.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, I've spoken to him since then, and he said he was at that and he'd seen you. So I can't He rings me up occasionally, and I saw him at that Alarm Festival, which is probably one of the last times I saw you, Steve, actually.
Oh, right, yeah.
At Alarm this year.
That's great. That is a great festival, yeah.
Need to speak about, but we're talking, while we're talking about, well, we're not really talking, but we should get on to the fall. So I need to know a bit more about this trip to Brazil, because I believe you were both on that, weren't you?
We were, but I'm going to just, I'm going to backtrack slightly to
Okay. Okay.
Early 85, and you were playing a gig at Woolwich Coronet, which I was promoting.
Right.
John Leonard had just taken over as the Fall's manager, and I was just becoming mates with John. And as you know, I went on to work with him, which is why I ended up here with you guys. And John phoned me up and he said, it's about 2:30 in the afternoon. He said, the band had just left Manchester. I was like, oh, right, okay. This is quite a big venue. We sold about 500 tickets. I was running a series of gigs there every Thursday, Friday night, I think. Big old cinema with Woolwich. And he said, yeah, but they hope they'll have one by the time the gig starts. So all right, okay. But Paul, you got the train down to the gig and were the drummer, as I remember.
I was just about to say, of all the gigs in 1980s, that was one of the few I did with the folk, because Carl had gone walkabout.
Carl had left the band that morning. He wouldn't get in the van and ran off, apparently. And
yes.
I think Mark had only been half truthful with John about what was going on, but they got you. But there was a problem because I think you were still doing your A levels or something.
No, I wasn't. I was in a band myself then. We had a gig in, I think it was in Birmingham the night before, I think.
Well, that's right. They were trying to find you. But anyway, I remember going off thinking, well, they'll work it out. And coming back, and you were just finishing the sound check, and there was a great drummer playing drums, and it was you.
Thank you very much, sir. God bless you.
Had you had any rehearsals then, Paul?
The bollocks. No, I had a CD that I had to listen to on the train. So I've got the set list here. And there are 1, 2, 3, 4 songs that I played on when I was in the band. So I left at the end. I left at the end of 84.
Right.
And this was the 6th of February, 86, so a year, basically.
It was 86, yeah. February, 86.
There was 4 songs that had been 4 songs when I was in them, a year later.
You were spoiled then.
I was spoiled, yeah.
More than Marcia did when we put them at the Albion Empire about a few months later, which was kind of... It was like... Well,
the best one I had was, what I heard, was Tommy Crooks joined. Yeah, they gave him a cassette. Gave him a set with 8 songs on to learn and didn't play any of them.
None of them are in the set on the night.
So February the 6th, 2 days later, amazing love, we played Liverpool. That was my last gig with the Fall. Somebody not unknown to you, Mr. John Cooper Clarke.
Oh, a Fall and Clarke gig. Okay, right.
Well, it was amazingly enough, not a bad one to bow out on. It was New Order, the Fall, the Smiths, and John Cooper Clarke.
Right, so you played that. Well, that's really is the legendary gigs, isn't it? Although I did.
We had 4 drummers that night.
No, you only had 1 drummer. There might have been 4 drummers
there. Was 4 in the room that were potential.
No, you're exaggerating. There's only 3.
What, so Steve Davis was there as well.
Well, you can't call him a drummer. And I mean, I speak as a close friend of his. So yeah, that was the benefit gig for the Liverpool Council, wasn't it? I think.
Clark sort of vaguely remembers it. I don't think he was particularly... Although he would have been without a habit then, actually, so I don't know why he doesn't remember it.
I remember he was... Well, I mean, he's never been exactly Pavarotti, has he? But I remember he was there. He was pencil thin.
Yeah.
And he said he came in and he said, when the book sold me these kecks, he said they were skin tight. I can sit down in my skin.
Well, he's just as thin as he ever was, but I tell you, he eats like a horse. I've no idea where it goes.
How does that work?
I don't know. There's a lot of women who'd like to know that. I tell you.
You bottle it. Yeah. So you weren't involved in
in that gig, were you promoting it?
No, I wasn't. That was, I mean, I was very much, I'd left Manchester in a huff when they offered me the job of assistant manager of the Hacienda, and then 4 days before it opened, they told me that they'd given it to some guy called Mike Pickering.
Oh, he'll never amount to anything, will he?
Never go anywhere. So,
do you know why? Do you know why they did that all?
He was Rob's mate. That was solely the reason. And also because they didn't want Wisey involved, and I was working with Wisey.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah.
And which kind of makes sense.
Yeah, he did, actually. And I got on the train a few days later, moved to London, became an agent in London, and suddenly I was representing Curtis Mayfield, Gil Scott Heron, and the Sid Lawrence Orchestra.
Bloody hell.
All worked out.
Yeah.
Sid Lawrence Orchestra, one of the first musical entities to record at Strawberry Studios.
I know. Well, I read your book, Paul, and I know.
So there must have been a time fairly early on when you thought you'd done yourself a favour there, when, you know, you'd go in on the Hacienda and there'd be about five people in there.
Oh, yeah.
There was all that going on. But then I went back with Curtis in June 83, the same tour we headlined Glastonbury. So it was June 83. And we had a guaranteed fee of £2,500.
Bloody hell. And that was a lot of money in 1983, wasn't it?
Well, it wasn't. You're talking about a soul superstar. He didn't sell that well. He was another more famous than popular sort of artist.
Yeah. And
Rob insisted that he'd only taken £2,000 on the door and that I could have that. Well, that £500 was a sort of, you know, that was kind of our profit on the tour kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I fell out with them very badly at the back end of that, but then became friends with them all again. But Curtis came off stage, and I won't try and do his voice, but he said to me, "Is this supposed to be somewhere special, Phil?" I said, "Well, you know, it's quite a place, isn't it, Curtis?" And he said, "That's the worst sound I've ever had in
my life." Oh, yeah.
It was appalling, wasn't it?
The sound. I don't know if it was so bad outside, but it was shocking on stage, wasn't it?
I always thought it was the other way around. I always thought it was okay on stage and lousy in the room.
Well, Curtis basically said to me that he spent the whole evening trying to get the monitors right. He kept asking the monitor guy to do things, couldn't get them right, because all he was getting was the bounce back off the, off the wall at the other side.
Yeah, it was like playing in a yacht showroom, wasn't it?
It was, for a funny reason, that, isn't it? A yacht showroom.
Yeah. I remember that. I remember when I was a kid and we used to get the bus. We used to go in to see my Auntie Mary on the other side. Yeah. And it was always just the 108 used to turn round there.
Yeah.
I was just, why is there a yacht showroom in the middle of town?
I'm just popping out to buy a yacht. I'll be back in half.
Yeah. I'm getting off down the canal.
Get a loaf while you're out, will you?
That and milk and a yacht, please. Yeah.
Did they get them in down the canal?
No, they
don't know.
They brought them in through that big door. I remember seeing a yacht being delivered in there and thinking, why has somebody got a yacht sales? Like,
Who's buying yachts in Manchester?
Yachts in that area of Manchester. I mean,
Well, my dad worked like 2 minutes from there. He worked at Dunlop's. He often popped in on his way home.
What, buy a yacht?
Buy a yacht on the way home, yeah. So we
only sold two today.
It's all plain sailing, is it?
Bizarre.
So if you didn't get the job just before the Hacienda, were you involved with it while they were getting it ready to open?
No, well, this was the whole thing. They kept saying, we want you to do this job, we're not going to let you see it. I kept saying, well, can I come and see it? Can I get my job description, what you're paying me? And all I get was deadly silence. I was talking by that Howard Jones, Ginger Jones, who was the first manager. And he kept saying, I'll come back to you. And this was literally 4 or 5 days before the place opened. And I went down and had the meeting in the Hacienda. And I have to say, I was like, bloody hell, I've never seen anything like this. It is quite an incredible scenario. You know? But the first thing I said is, why is the stage here? And they said,
well, that's the old one, isn't it? The stage is where the bar should be.
Yeah. And they said, oh, that's where Tony wants it. I said, well, I think that's a mistake. So I was in this room and they were literally painting the yellow and black on the posters, on the pillars, and we were stood on the damn floor there. And Rob was there sort of scurrying about trying not to catch my eye, and Wilson was sort of talking to people, look, love, and all this kind of stuff. I was like, well, what's going on, Ginger? What's going on? And they said, he said, Rob wants his mate Mike Pickering to do it. I said, well, where's he from? They said, oh, he lives in Belgium. I'm like, oh, okay, well, he's about to know the scene. There you go.
Handy commute, isn't it?
but you... Yeah, go on.
So you had the last laugh then, in some ways. You went down to London. Is it, you moved out on New Year's Eve, is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. How did you know that? Yeah, very symbolically moved out on New Year's Eve, 1983, left Manchester. No, 1982, left Manchester. Woke up being an agent in London on the 2nd of January, 1983. Great.
Right. So who did you put on then? Well, obviously, Curtis Mayfield.
Well, it was a weird mixture. I mean, these guys I was working with were very much from what you call the civic theatre sort of realm, hence Sid Lawrence. We also represented George Melly, George Chisholm, Peter Sarsgaard, who never did any gig, by the way. But what we did is we were quite creative, and we got on the blower and found out, for example, Dean Friedman's home phone number, and we rang him up and we said, look, you know, you haven't been to Britain since Lydia was number one or whatever. Why don't you come and do a tour? And, of course, all the small theatres are, oh, yeah, we remember him. We loved his records. So we were quite inventive like that. We brought artists on board.
I bet he thanked his lucky stars he met you.
There's the point. Because, yes, he did. He was in a venue in Morecambe a few months back, and he'd literally played the night before. So 40 years later, he's still doing it. But he organises it all himself. He learned all the tricks off me and then started doing it himself.
Well, that's the way to do it if you've got any sense.
Exactly. Who needs it?
You don't want to get to 60 odd years of age and still be relying on agents to get your gigs, do you, Steve?
No, you wouldn't.
Anyway, but your first question was about going to Rio de Janeiro with the four.
Yes,
it was.
Do you want me to come back to that?
You can, yes. I mean, obviously, we'll edit this together to be seamless and chronological and everything else. If you've ever, you know, obviously, you haven't heard any of them, but we you know, it can get as rambling as it wants.
Right.
Right,
okay. Well, my memory of it is that I was basically a ligger, but as far as Mark was concerned, I was the management. And it was the one time he ever shouted at me. Mark and I always got on really well, probably because I kept my distance and I only kind of hung out with him when we were going for the last train back to Manchester and that kind of thing from London. But we had those two weird roadies with us and he pulled me out. He said, what the effing hell are these guys doing? I said, well, I don't know.
Who was it?
It was two guys that I can't say his name, but his initials are TL, brought with him. Ring any bells, Steve? There was a guy
who
had long ginger hair and was wearing shorts when he got on the aeroplane, which, of course, went. I've got some great pics of you guys. And the fall was then. It was you, Craig, Martin.
Mine, Marsha.
And Si.
And Si, yeah.
All on Copacabana Beach. And you're all in your long trousers.
Yeah. The overcoat.
Yeah. You didn't possess a pair of shorts, did you, Steve?
No. But my legs, the world's never seen my legs.
It's quite an experience because all these sort of Brazilian, you know, sort of bodybuilders are all looking at these guys lying down on this great picture. But my memory is I tagged along because it was a spare airfare, but I was sort of minding Mark a bit, and we arrived in Rio. And
hang on a minute, just say that that's the only time I've ever been on a plane and turned left.
Yeah, yeah.
I know. So you blagged your way to Brazil the only time the fall went first class.
Yeah, and we were first class back and we nearly had the plane to ourselves, if I remember that. We got back the day that Dry Bar opened. There's a funny thing, I remember that. But the point of the story is that there was a press conference. We arrived at sort of 6 a.m. in the morning, went to Rio de Janeiro, and we were staying in that tallest hotel right on the beach, Copacabana Beach. You remember it, Steve? And there was a conference, and they said, oh, you must come to this press conference at 10 a.m. And Mark was like, do we have to? I want to go. And I was like, well, we better do it. But of course, it wasn't just a press conference. It was a freeloading booze festival. And he and I were drinking champagne at 5 past 10 in the morning.
That wasn't the day of the gig, was it?
No, it was the day before.
No.
gig was with Laurie Anderson the day after, and we were drinking champagne at 10:05 in the morning, fielding these questions in broken English from Brazilian journalists, getting completely Lego on the top floor of the hotel, the tallest hotel that's on the hotel on the Copacabana Beach. And I was thinking, this is absolutely insane. Absolutely insane.
And yet all too true to form, he didn't think to bring any of the band to the free champagne reception.
Oh, it was funny that, Steve. I think you lot all went to bed, actually, but he wasn't very keen to do it. But of course, we walked in there and there's all these bottles of champagne on ice, and I went, hey, we've landed up. But by 10:15 in the morning in Rio de Janeiro, I couldn't see.
Oh, that's what you did for the rest of the day.
Yeah, well, exactly. You know, I think, I don't know. Well, we went on the beach, I think.
Very nice.
Yeah.
I've got a little connecting story about that. I don't know if I've told you this before, but so that is the only time I ever went first class. And I was getting in my big seat, you know, on the plane.
Yeah,
and I dropped my AA card on the floor of the plane. And Mark picked it up and he's going, he's in AA, don't give him any champagne to this air hostess.
You mean the Automobile Association card?
Yeah. I do remember that, actually. I'd forgotten it, but I do remember it. Yeah, it was a good trip, that one. With Di and the late, great Eddie as well.
Yes, of course.
Was it Acorn as well?
Yeah.
I don't know if there was a lot of.
Yeah?
A lot of freelance.
Enough, there was a lot of us on that trip.
Yeah.
Fully that, yeah.
Was
the gig any good?
I can't remember.
Yeah, it was great, yeah. It was in a club, a big club, but it was like a series of three gigs. It was Philip Glass, Laurie Anderson, and us.
I remember because I talked to Laurie Anderson. I promoted her a few times afterwards, and when I promoted her at Manchester Apollo, actually, probably about 20 years ago, I mentioned the gig, and she said, oh, that was the fall, were just the best thing I've ever seen in my life that night. So she stayed and watched the gig, I remember.
So there you go, Steve. That's I'm sure she's seen Lou Reed a few times. The fall was the best thing she's ever seen. I'll say that.
Yeah.
I'm not saying she was with Lou then. I don't know if she got together with Lou. It's probably late 90s, actually. Although, hang on, because I think Lou Reed was at one of the gigs. This is it, you forget. I know I've met Lou Reed at somewhere in Manchester.
How was he?
I wouldn't say he was talkative. It was a kind of a nod to the various questions I asked him, and then I thought, well, I'll give up here. Yeah.
So we'll have to move on a bit. You were involved in the Olympic bid, weren't you? I believe.
Well, no, I was involved in the Olympic festival that was put on alongside the Olympic bid. We had to prove that we were culturally. You're supposed to do an arts festival. I don't know what.
Yeah.
They decided to prove. And I'd just become the Manchester Festival Director. It was only a part-time job, to be honest. I was half working at JLP and half working in Manchester. And they said, right, we're bidding for the Olympics. We need an Olympic festival. You're the director. And I was like, oh, right, okay, what are you paying me? And I said, all right, then, thank you. And we all know what was a very good festival. It was hard work. And I managed to... umbrella the Stone Roses at Spike Island as being part of the Olympic Festival. And if you've still got your ticket out there, you'll see rings, but what we were allowed to use as the logo on your ticket for Spike Island.
Wow. Yeah. What was that like, Spike Island?
That was hard work, God.
I bet it was.
Well, it was a great gig, but there was two problems. Number one, there weren't enough security because a well-known, probably the biggest security firm in the world, but then quite a small outfit, some bus from Leeds never turned up with 60 security.
Good God.
And then one of the band's managers told the head of security that they weren't allowed to let anybody in with food or drink. So everybody got their food or drink taken, didn't they? And of course, the day, but it turned out a good gig. We were weirdly enough, I was looking at the contract with the council the other day, and we had 13 different points around Widnes where they had the, you know, the sound, you know, they tested the sound for how loud it was.
Decibel, I think, yeah.
The council said if it went over that limit in any one place for more than, I think it was 30 seconds, then they had the right to turn the gig off. So the PA company were very nervous about that, you know, so they built the PA so it didn't. But a lot of people said the sound wasn't very good, but as far as I was concerned, the sound was fantastic, you know.
Right.
It blew a bit because we were on an island on the edge of the River Mersey, you know, right by the Irish Sea, and there was a spring. That was the other thing that nearly happened. We nearly had to abandon the island, you know, evacuate the island. We were about 18 inches off with the tide, having to evacuate the island.
Not bloody hell.
Not a lot of people know that. What happened was, is it was a spring neap tide, full moon, all that kind of thing. And, you know, the tide comes in really quickly in the Mersey. And there was a level. I mean, this, I mean, Spike Island, it really is, it is an island because the Mersey runs down one side and there's a canal down the other side. And, you know, it takes the full thrust of the Mersey coming in from the Irish Sea. And the tide was going to be high, but nobody had told me that. Nobody had said, oh, on that day, we're going to have the highest tide of the spring. So we had a spring. And this copper, senior copper who's in charge, you know, I don't know, chief inspector, whatever, he came up to me and he said, Phil, got a problem developing here. I said, what's that? He said, we might have to evacuate the island. And I was like, he said, well, this tide is coming in and it's coming in even higher than we expected. I said, well, why didn't somebody tell me this? He said, well, we didn't think it was a problem, but it's coming in faster and higher than we've ever seen it. And he said, there's a certain level where it is going to start coming over where your spectators are, your fans are. I was like, well, how far away are we? He said, we're about 3 foot. And I was like, what? This place. And he said, it's very nearly high tide, but the rate it's coming up, we could have a problem here. And quite literally, the tide, I mean, it was like a torrent. It wasn't like a tide. It was it was a torrent coming back up the Mersey. And he said that line, he got a load of constables who stood along the line.
So how close to the gig was this?
Well, not far, you know, 20 metres where the punters were.
No, I mean, in terms of time?
Oh, early mid-afternoon, I'd say, 4 hours, like that. And the gig was, but, you know, people had already started playing. We had.
Yeah. So how would you have got them out?
God knows, you tell me. Wouldn't have happened, would it?
And this
as well, he said, I don't know what we're going to do, but there's a certain level where it gets to a flat area and then it's just going to go all over here.
Yeah.
We you know, you see the water raising as you were looking at it, and we sort of stood there and it got up and it got up, and some of these coppers, it was literally touching the feet that were moving back, you know.
Christ.
Bloody.
I can see why you weren't so concerned about the sound maybe not being quite as good as it could be.
He said, I walked away from it. I said, well, just come and find me. I've got more important things than it. I walked off the site. What the fuck, like you're saying, you know, how are we going to deal with it? He radioed me and he said, I think we've just got away with it, Phil. It's started. It's got as high as it's getting. And you're going to be okay. And I have to say, that was a relief. But then the band came on finally. Yeah, I don't know if you were there. And of course,
never saw the Stone Roses, never.
I have to say, they were brilliant. Everybody stood up at the same time because they didn't want a sort of, you know, Happy Mondays type support act, although Sean was there. So everybody stood up at the same time. And it had been a chemical factory. And it had been really dry for the whole month and it was just full of dust and all this dust went up in the air and a load of people who were asthmatic got badly done. And this poor kid, you know, was rushed to hospital and I was told that he died. And that was...
Oh, my God.
Yeah, that was horrible. He hadn't died. His heart had stopped, but they brought him round.
Oh,
so that was my memories of Spike Island. But it was a good gig. I organised the Ali Pali gig for them as well. That was a much better gig. But again, sound problem.
Yeah, I mean, the if you're telling the story of Spike Island, it's a long way down the list whether the sound was any good, isn't it?
People complain about it, but as far as I remember, it was absolutely brilliant. But there was a gale force wind blowing across, so, and there were these guys saying, you know, oh, it's gone above 93 decibels, we're going to turn the whole thing off. And they had the right, so I'd signed a contract saying they could do it.
Who picked the venue?
Certainly not me.
Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse.
Gareth Evans, the band's manager.
Ah, Gareth.
We've been looking for venues around the country, and we looked at sort of weird sort of motocross tracks in Essex and all sorts of places. And he rang me up one day. I was still living in Chorlton. I remember him ringing me up. Said, I found the spot. So where is it? He said, Widnes. I'm like, all right. And I've been to Widnes because my wife's from down that way. And I was like, where? He said, it's an island in the Mersey. I was like, I've never noticed that before. But of course it was, they had put on, there was an annual kind of, I don't know, local community festival used to take place there every year. And he'd been to it, I don't know, or somebody had told him about it. He'd gone down and had a look. And we had the meeting there. It was January the 4th, 1990. The wind was blowing in, it was snowing. It was the coldest day on earth, and I said to Roger, the guy I produced it with, who did the stage, who was proper health and safety sort of guy, you know. I said, "Are we going to be able to do this?" "Oh, it'll be fine." And he was okay.
It's more than okay, wasn't it?
It's quite a legendary gig.
They made a film of it, didn't they?
Film's great, yeah.
Well, you mean that film about the kids who can't get in because they haven't got the
team. Kids who can't get in, yeah.
Yeah, that was. I ended up getting quite well paid out of that.
Yeah,
you owned the copyright on the tickets, you see.
Ah, right.
Copyright off me for the ticket.
Very good. So, I mean, would you say that was your most famous gig you did? Do you think?
I mean, it's one of the most famous gigs in the United Kingdom of all time, isn't it?
Really.
So, you know, yeah, I think I can't think of anything more famous, really. REM Green Tour, I did a lot of the shows on that, Liverpool, Phil, Nottingham, that kind of thing, and that's sort of, as a tour, that's a groundbreaking tour, isn't it?
Right, yeah, of course, that was just before they got massive.
Yeah, well, we did the Royal Court in Liverpool, somewhere, Nottingham, Rock City, those kind of gigs, you know, and it was REM, and I just thought, this band, they're great on record, but they're just, whoever's mixing the sound has never mixed sound before because you couldn't hear them. It was just but then I saw them a few weeks later, came back and did another gig, and it all made sense to me.
Right, well, I saw them live because I really liked them on record as well. I never thought they were very good live. So we saw, they were at a football stadium. I can't remember where it was now. A rugby stadium, maybe.
Huddersfield.
Yes. With the beautiful South supporting.
Beautiful South supporting. I went as a punter to that, and that was the first time I got REM live, actually. I thought they were great that night.
But well, there you go. Right, then. Old opinions, innit? I thought Beautiful South were better than REM.
I thought Beautiful South were astonishing. And weirdly enough, my wife has known Pauline forever, you know, back in, what was his band before called?
House Martins.
Right, she was in the House Martins. And I'd been a sort of keen follower of his career, and I thought they were absolutely astonishing. Them, beautiful.
Yeah.
Huddersfield, something or other stadium.
Yes, McAlpine.
McAlpine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. McAlpine's Fusiliers. Because the one thing I know about that is a friend of ours, Colin, he worked with the Fall as well.
Yeah.
And he was a roadie for the Beautiful South, and he said it took longer to set the drinks out than it did to put the gear on.
Yeah, brilliant. Yeah. I don't know him anymore, but he's a good dad. Never really.
Yeah.
The only time I really met Paul was I don't know if he ever went to the matches, but I'm a Leeds fan. And he used to come and sit in the pub we went in before every match. But I don't know if he actually went to the matches. But he used to go in the same sort of snug boozer as I used to before Leeds matches. And they got
he's kind of more of a lower league guy, though, isn't he, I think?
Well, I don't know. I think his mates all went to the match and he just came for the drink before. But I never let on that was a Leeds.
Why not? You should have done. Should have been delighted.
No, I don't know. He goes around buying drinks for, you know, he puts like £1,000 down.
Yeah, he does. He does that on his birthday, and he did it on the last tour, didn't he?
Well done. Yeah, good man.
Yeah, yeah. Because that was good.
Occasionally bump into him in Didsbury.
Yeah.
Well, he's a PTA member, isn't he, at one of the schools or something, you know.
He is, yeah.
In the community.
Yeah. So I was going to ask him, because there was a big hoo-ha a bit about price, ticket pricing. And I think Bruce Springsteen was the one, the sort of flagship one that everybody said. And he was saying, there were a lot of people coming on saying, these prices are ridiculous. And why isn't Bruce Springsteen doing anything about it? And people came on and said, it's nothing to do with him. It's a promoter. He's got no say in it. And then Paul Eaton came back on and said, well, actually, you can, as an artist, sort of insist that fees are a certain level. So where do you stand on that ticket pricing these days?
You know, everybody's going to make some money. So the band's not going to be going out and, you know, losing money. And as you well know, putting a band in a van or in a tour bus and moving them about with all their crew and keeping them overnight, which is where a lot of the money goes.
Yes. I know that.
Money. Venues want a lot of money. You can't just sort of hire a Newcastle United footballers, you know, St James's Park Stadium for 30 quid. You know,
no.
They want to get their money on a sellout band. They've got to staff that venue as well, you know, and they've got to make sure it's secure. They've got to make sure the queues are dealt with, all the rest of it. You know, putting on any gig, whether it's in a little club or in a stadium, costs money.
Yes. And of course, the thing that bands don't make money out of records these days.
Well, you know, the bands have got to make some decent money. But what I say is, it's pure, you know, and I'm a socialist, but what I will say is market forces within capitalism. And if people will pay 165 quid to go and see Bruce Springsteen and he sells the 50,000 tickets, then what's the problem, you know?
Yeah.
I tend to deal in the sort of £20 to £40 sort of ticket prices. And what I will say, and I noticed this the other day, was inflation, you know, roaring inflation at the moment, but on ticket prices, it's been 2% in the last 24 months. That's probably got a bit to do with COVID. But mainly, you know, your average ticket prices haven't moved very much for the past 5 years before. But I mean, I think, you know, I read the other day as well that, you know, the rate of inflation increased in Sweden by so and so percent because Beyonce played two nights in a.
This is actually contributed to the whole economy of the country in a significant, you know, in a graphable way.
Yeah, well,
that's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, well, what happens is that Beyonce's fans all come down from, you know, the other environs of Sweden to Stockholm. The hotels all start charging a fortune. The campsites start charging a fortune. The restaurants put everything up a couple of krona. And suddenly, you know, those 100,000 people coming for three nights into Stockholm have made a real difference on the total spend. But because everybody's trying to maximise their income, they've all just knocked the prices up a bit, and it has a knock-on effect. But the main reason will have been because the Beyonce tickets were $200 or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, it's not the cheapest place on earth at the best of time, Stockholm, is it?
Well, you know, you pay £8 for a beer, they put it for £10, you know.
Yeah.
That's how it works. But that's a great thing about that people don't realise about every gig that takes place in the country, be it in 100 capacity or 100,000 capacity or 70,000 capacity, those people come to that place and spend money in that place.
Yeah.
Probably not just in that place, but they probably then do some at the day after if they're staying over. And it's a real boost to an economy. And even in my sort of gigs, you know, 1,000 capacity rooms, a lot of people travel to them. They spend the night over, they have the tea, you know. And that's why it's not always easy to sell tickets, because people think, well, I've got to travel, I've got to park, I've got to pay the babysitter, I've got to have my tea, I've got to get a taxi, you know, all that kind of thing. You think, well, it's 30 quid for a ticket, but actually we're spending 100 quid each a night. If people go ahead with it, then that's fine. If they don't, it is often because of the knock-on extra costs. But if you're an artist like Bruce Springsteen, Beyonce, people want to come, and within reason, they'll pay anything, you know.
Yeah, well, they will.
You know, and that's the market economy on it.
Yeah. I mean, you think about that, the overheads must be fairly colossal.
It does make you think, though, if Paul Eaton can make it work, how much money are they actually making?
Yeah, but Paul, you see, he's probably not thinking, well, I want to trouser $5,000 myself on this. You know, he's probably thinking, well, I'm, you know, I've sold more records than anybody else from Hull, and, you know, I'm...
So do you think that's where
I suspect the person who didn't get paid was him, you know.
Right.
Or he took a massive wage cut to do it. But, you know, all power to him.
you know, I don't know whether he needs the money or not. But
I was going to say, we can argue all day about whether Paul Eaton needs the money, but I think most of us could probably agree that Bruce Springsteen and Beyonce don't.
Yeah, but the band do, the crew do.
Of course. I'm being flippant.
Well, but, I mean, the point is, something like Bruce Springsteen, he'll have his 10-piece band, his 15-piece band or whatever, but every one of them will have somebody working for them. Every one of them will have a tour bus driver. Every one of them will have a HG. Mm. There's probably 200 people working on that tour, riggers, you know, runners, all the rest of it, catering, you know. They've all got to be paid. I mean, and then you've got to cater for the 200 people who are at Newcastle United Stadium, you know, working.
Yeah.
No, and not just giving them a McDonald's at 5 o'clock. You've got to give them breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and then some after as well.
Yeah.
You know, so that's a lot of money. And I suspect Bruce probably, I'm certainly, he's got a good management. He won't have been short, but he was probably last. I mean, Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young, who, you know, two of them became. You know, Crosby's dead now, but Nash is a good mate of mine. In fact, he's on at the Bridgewater Hall on September the 13th. Get your tickets now.
Is he?
Yeah. And Graham told me, basically, they did that first proper United States and Canada Stadium tour, 1974, went right through the summer. They were the last to get paid out of about 300 people along the road. And they, yeah. I mean, Crosby called it the Doom Tour because it... they didn't get any money out of it. I mean, they did, but not very much. So, well, it's always the band that's the last to get paid, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Well, there's that. Well, I don't think merch was in its infancy then, was it? Because there's a lot of money in merch now, isn't there?
Well, you took the words out of my mouth. If you get your merch right, but again, we're being sharked on that as well. Venues are taking 25% of the merch.
That's disgrace.
Excuse my friends. That's fucking outrageous, that, isn't it?
Yeah. It really is.
I'm not going to name the venue, but it's in Manchester and it's quite big. They take 25% of you.
Percent, yeah.
25%.
Roundhouse does as well. We played the Roundhouse support in the wedding present.
Yeah.
Mm. And they wanted 25% of our merch. I mean, you know, you're talking about 25% of bugger all, really. But, you know.
It's 25% plus VAT. So you've got to take in, you know, we're getting very complicated for your average punter here, but believe you me, there isn't a lot left for, and also swag merch has gone up in, you know, t-shirts to print them now has gone up drastically there. They, and delivery and pickup is just unbelievable.
Yeah.
So the cost of making merch, it was a great way to make money, but you know, Bruce Springsteen at Newcastle United, 50,000 people, I bet he sold 20,000 t-shirts. Interestingly enough, it was because of Bruce Springsteen's tour in about 85, there's a thing called Foreign Entertainers Tax, because he was on his merch. Somebody said, well, hang on a minute, he's got all this money in fees, but he's sold £1 million worth of t-shirts as well, and he's taking that all back to America. Shouldn't he be getting taxed on that? And we were then blessed with what's called the Foreign Entertainers Tax, where anybody from overseas, and it really is overseas, it used to be non-EU, but now it's you can be from Belgium. This is how much it's cost me to get here, do the gigs, and this is how much I've made, and... you know, all the rest of it. Because Bruce ran off with a million worth of merch.
Right.
Everybody,
it's not his fault.
Well, it was him that got one MP noticed it. They went, how much did he take? And he's taken all that back to the States. Hang on. So that was, it changed the shape of the live music industry.
Yeah. So how viable is it now, do you think, for a band? Let's pluck a size of band out of the air. Say a 5-piece band. They've got, the playing venues, maybe the size of the White Hotel or Gorilla, for want of a better venue. How viable do you think it is these days? How viable can you make it?
It's not, is it? Because you can't, I mean, you know, you can't hire a van for less than, what, you know, 100 quid a day. You can't, you know, I mean, not viable, is it? Unless the ticket price goes right up. But if you're playing those kind of venues, people go, well, I don't really know this band. I'm not going to pay 25 quid. I'll only pay 12, you know. So at that level, the ticket price is very crucial as to what you end up with. But again, the venues have got fixed costs and they won't, and you know, and the promoter needs a cut. And then if you're an organised band, you've got an agent and a manager as well. Well, the agent and a 15%, and your manager, if he's you know, unless he's daft, he's taking no less than 20% off the top. So you get a fee of 700 quid.
It's a shit business.
Well, exactly. You know, you've lost 70 quid to your agent, 140 quid to your manager. That's 210 quid. You've got 490 quid left. Well, you know, you're staying in a hotel and you've got a Van Hour and Patrick, you've driven from London. You've got your... You're losing money, aren't you?
And on that, I'll tell you what, they call it.
were you on our last tour?
Well, I'll tell you what, a funky Si said to me that the last F All tour, he made more money than he'd ever made in his life.
We did, yeah, to be fair. We did pretty well on that last tour.
Really well, actually, yeah. Well done, yeah.
Well done. Yeah. Was doing something right, but it's because you've got no manager, all right? Oh, you have got an agent.
We have got an agent, no manager.
Yeah, I know. Well, I had a bit of a plug at Martin on Si's insistence, but, you know, maybe we'll come back to that.
Yeah. We're always all for business. Now, before we go, because we've reached our hour, I was just going to ask you about the Manchester Food and Drink Festival.
Yeah.
You're involved in that, aren't you? That's massive now, isn't it?
Well, yeah. It was massive, but I've knocked it on the head as it stands.
Have you?
Well, we've done 25 of them. I invented it 26 years ago. And... to be honest, there's a street food event round every corner in Manchester now. So we've had a sort of year, we're having a year off this year. We're still doing our awards, but instead of doing them in October, we're doing them in January next year.
Right.
And we're going to relaunch something for next year. But with a slight, I mean, when I started it, it was to highlight that I'd come up from London and I'd realised really that Manchester restaurants, this is 1996 sort of time. Yeah. Manchester restaurants were fairly average, really, and they had no idea about service and they didn't know about training or anything. And quite a vibrant scene in London. I was knocking around with a lot of restaurateurs in London. And I thought, well, there's got to be a way of, and the slogan was, there's more to Manchester than pies. And I thought we've got to highlight the two, you know, four or five restaurants in Manchester. So we were doing events in the restaurants, you know, Heathrow. Right. That sort of thing, to highlight there was something. And then gradually it's all trickled outdoors and the whole street food and, you know, outdoor dining thing has become quite a big thing. But quite literally, it's not a special thing anymore.
Right.
And it's very hard, again, it's very hard to make ends meet. If you're doing something outdoors, like, for example, last year, we had to move the first week of the Food and Drink Festival because of the Queen's mourning period. So the first week became the week after the second week. We couldn't get the marquees for the third week, so we had to go to a different marquee supplier. It rained nearly every day. It became the second week became the first week of October instead of the third week of September.
It
rained nearly every day. It was just hard work, you know. And I just thought, it's too tired, this formula now. So we're literally in the middle of rethinking it all again. So we'll relaunch something. But I'm very proud of the Food and Drink Festival, and most especially of the Food and Drink Festival Awards, which have come out as being the ones that everybody wants to win. And quite literally, I've been doing a bit of research on the Food and Drink Festival. We've had over the, I think, 23 years we've done awards, something approaching 3,000 different outlets nominated. And every single one of those outlets will have had their trade boosted. And if they've won, they're laughing all the way to the bank, you know.
Well, because the Manchester food scene is incredible now, isn't it?
Oh, it's extraordinary. And I don't think anybody needs that kind of help, that kind of, but it's at the same time, I hate saying this, but there's too much going on. And people are struggling. Obviously, people have got less money to on their social life. And, you know, the restaurants have had to put them, I mean, God, I had a meal the other day and I could see why it cost what it did. But I was like, if I'd have known it was going to, my bills were going to end up at this amount, I probably wouldn't have come in, you know, and I'm not going back because it's all the little extras and then you get the, you know, the optional tip on top. But, you know, it's a really competitive industry. Rents have gone up. Insurance has gone up massively, massively, massively for those kind of businesses. And it's just hard work again, like everything to make ends meet when you're in a competitive scenario. I haven't done it as much since before COVID, but before COVID, I was doing a lot of, do you mind if I pick your brains, Phil, you know, on people opening restaurants?
Yeah.
And I used to say, here's what I want to tell you. Keep it as cheap as you possibly can be without it being tacky. Don't overdo your menu and just think small rather than spending £3 million on the fixtures and fittings, which people, and they inevitably go bust 6 months later. I could name you a restaurants were. Yeah. You know, go and get recycled tables, you know, go to the junk shop in Levensium and buy the chairs from there. Because you don't necessarily need to have, people aren't necessarily after glitzy, they're after atmosphere, aren't they?
Yeah.
And yeah. It's like, play the right music, you know, but get a vibe on the place. And places that do that survive, but, you know, there's too many ambitious places and that, unfairly, because of the economy, there's too much competition because it has reached just a fantasy. I mean, you can eat. When we started the Food and Drink Festival, with I think over 50 different types of international cuisine in Manchester, and that included cafes in Monton as much as it included, you know, places like Deansgate, tapas bars on Deansgate. Now we're up to like 98, I think somebody told me, different types of countries' cuisines in the
different types. Never mind how many of each there are.
Well, exactly. And then every one of them's got four or five restaurants. And of course, everybody wants to, you know. And the other problem is, and this is a great thing, but it's not a great thing. The thing I love about Manchester is that the suburbs have taken off as, and all great cities, you can dine well in the suburbs.
Yeah.
You do that in Manchester now.
You can now, yeah.
And the city centre isn't perhaps quite. You know, it's still busy, but people aren't necessarily thinking, oh, that must be a great place because it's on Deansgate, you know.
Yes.
I think people have, I mean, Burton Road is just absolutely incredible, isn't it? You know?
It is.
And, you know, you go to Barcelona and you, all right, the city centre is great, but it's for tourists. But if you ask the locals where to dine, they'll say, oh, just go down here 200 yards and turn right and you'll see so and so, you know, and that's where you're going. And that's the great thing about those big cities.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Food and Drink Festival, great idea. Very proud of it, but being relaunched soon.
Right. Watch this space. Yeah. Right, well, on that bombshell, Philip, I think we're going to have to say good evening.
Good evening, yeah, okay.
Marvellous to talk to you. That's great, that. Yeah. Really enjoyed that. Thanks for joining us for this week's Old Brother. Episodes are released every 2 weeks, so keep an eye out for episode 3 coming soon. You can find us on Spotify and Apple and all usual suspects, and we're hosted at shows.acast.com/oh-brother. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Old Brother Show to keep up with all the latest news about us. And don't forget to like us, give us a rating on your favourite platform. You can even tell your friends about us if you like. And remember, if you're driving, take your car. Ta-da.
Avant que vous n'écoutiez votre podcast, Acast nous permet de vous présenter le nôtre, Speakeasy by Influx. Chaque semaine, trois entrepreneurs partagent leur expérience autour d'un verre. Ils discutent d'entrepreneuriat, de productivité et de créativité. On a donné des conseils pour gérer l'échec, discuté de l'importance de prendre des décisions rapides, de l'intelligence artificielle dans le travail et des 30 leçons de vie que vous n'apprendrez qu'à 30 ans. Manuel Diaz, Romain Lanéry et moi-même, Léo Duff, ne sommes jamais d'accord sur ces sujets, donc on est sûr que vous aimerez au moins l'un d'entre nous et détesterez les deux autres. Allez, on vous sert un verre, à tout de suite dans Speakeasy by Influx.